Good morning, everyone. Today is February 29th, a special day for a special event. To both our live audience and virtual participants, welcome. Thank you for joining us for Leap into the Community, a technical assistance workshop on community-based participatory research, also known as CBPR. CBPR is an applied approach that enables community residents to more actively participate in the full spectrum of research with the goal of influencing change in community health, systems, programs, or policies. CBPR begins with a research topic of importance to the community with the aim of combining knowledge and action for social change to improve community health. Researchers partner with the community to develop models and approaches to building communication, trust, and capacity with the final goal of increasing community participation in the research process. This collaborative approach to research equitably involves all partners in the research process and recognizes the unique strengths that each brings. So why focus on CBPR, and why now? Community-based participatory research is increasingly recognized as a vital missing link needed to bridge the gap in the U.S. healthcare system between biomedical research, everyday medical care, and improved health outcomes. The advantages of CBPR are plentiful, most notably joining partners with diverse expertise to address complex public health problems, improving intervention design and implementation by facilitating participant recruitment and retention, and lastly, it possesses the potential to translate research findings to guide the development of further interventions and policy change. Ultimately, it benefits the researchers and community alike through the knowledge gained and actions taken. CBPR is relatively new at NIH. The institutes and centers are progressively supportive of community-based participatory research, releasing more than 25 CBPR-related funding announcements during 2000 and 2008, with the support of 15 of the 27 institutes and centers. Other federal agencies have demonstrated strong support for this research, including the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, and the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality, ARC. So if you're interested in either learning more about CBPR, establishing a partnership to engage in CBPR, or if you have a desire to become a CBPR NIH grantee, you've come to the right place. I've planned this technical workshop for you. My goal is for all participants to leave with valuable information and insight into community-based participatory research. The general purpose is to provide you with a clear understanding of what CBPR is and what it is not. Also, to help you identify funding opportunities at the National Institutes of Health, as well as share pertinent information on surviving the review process and obtaining NIH funding for this research. Further, you will receive guidance on how to prepare responsive applications to the three CBPR funding opportunity announcements released on January 16, 2008 by my office, the Office of Behavioral and Social Sciences Research. To this end, I have arranged for NIH program directors and chiefs, fellow members of the NIH CBPR Scientific Interest Group, director of the HRSA Shortage Designation Branch, and two pairs of successful CBPR partners to present throughout the day. The opening session will offer grant writing tips and specific recommendations for first-time applicants. It will also explain CBPR and its presence here at NIH. The second session will discuss lessons learned from previous CBPR funding opportunity announcements, including critical issues and research proposals on community-based participatory research. The third session specifically covers CBPR interventions and the PA-08-074 funding announcement, including effective interventions and examples of successful CBPR applications to NIH. The fourth session discusses HRSA's medically underserved areas and populations designation guidelines. Additionally, you will be briefed on how best to navigate the designation application and renewal processes, which relate to the PAR-08-075 and-076 funding announcements. Finally, the closing session features two separate pairs of established partners. One pair will highlight what it takes for community-based organizations and academia to successfully partner to conduct CBPR and the benefits of these efforts. The second pair will discuss conducting CBPR in rural areas, offering a description of the unique challenges associated with this work and advice on how best to overcome them. Today's technical assistance workshop raises awareness about and highlights the relevance of CBPR while offering guidance on conducting it. Following this event, you will be fully equipped to leap into the community. All of today's presentations have been made available to you on the CBPR Scientific Interest Group's website, which is accessible directly from the webcast. Please feel free to print copies, follow along, and take notes. I want to take this opportunity to recognize the founders of the Trans-NIH CBPR Scientific Interest Group, NCI's Shobha Srinivasan, NIMH's Carmen Moten, and NHLBI's Jared Job. Thank you for working diligently to establish an official home for CBPR at the National Institutes of Health. That leads us to the opening session entitled Look Before You Leap, which features the current leadership of the CBPR Scientific Interest Group, Bill Elwood, Jeff Evans, and Paul Cotton. Gentlemen, let's begin.
And thank you, Dana, not just for introducing this segment, but also for putting all this together. A lot of good people have come together to provide you with this information today, but none of this would have been possible without Dana's leadership and coordination skills. So thank you very much, Dana. I want to be sure, too, that, well, first of all, we can't continue to do these sorts of trainings unless we demonstrate that people indeed are interested and value them. So the main way we do that is through numbers. And so I want to be sure that everyone here who is here in the room has registered. Is there anybody who hasn't signed in on the registration form? Okay, terrific. Thank you very much. And thank you for coming out there in webinar land. Uncle Sam, Aunt Dana, and I want you to submit an application featuring CBPR to the National Institutes of Health. As Dana told you, CBPR has been becoming increasingly prevalent at NIH. And here are three recent examples of the programs that have come about. The Trans-NIH Partners in Research Program that NICHD has been and NINR have been the leaders of, and those applications will be reviewed shortly, and these other two. We're mainly here today to talk about the three new funding opportunity announcements that fall under two program announcements. This first one is a standard program announcement, community participation in research. You'll see that this name continues from an expired program announcement with special receipt and review requirements. But this old name has new substance. And you can see the program announcement number there. You'll notice that unlike the previous version, this is for an R01 only, for community-based participatory interventions. Unlike the past version, it has standard submission dates, the standard review process. There is no set-aside funding, which is standard for program announcements. And you can see the agencies and institutes that are supporting this at this time. Here, the second and third foes that fall under one PAR. It's important to note, I think, at this time, that program announcements are NIH's standard way of saying, hello, we'd like to see applications in these areas. But some people in the applicant community, including myself before I came here, thought that everything that came out of NIH had set aside funds. And that's not the case. RFAs invariably do. PAs almost never have a special pot of money, and PARs seldom do as well. The special pots of money generally apply to RFAs and to PASs. The S in that stands for set-aside funds. Okay. Let's get back to this. You can see these two announcements came out last month. Letters of intent deadlines are coming up. we need receipt date by May 16th, and this will be a special panel review. That's part of the R in PAR. There will be a special emphasis panel convened expressly to review these applications, and you'll learn more about the details in the medically underserved populations and areas. You can see, too, the institutes that have signed on to support this announcement or these announcements. The asterisks signify that those two organizations are supporting R01s only and not our exploratory developmental mechanism, the R21. You know, Russ Feingold called me the other day and he said, "Dr. Bill, what makes a good NIH application?" And I had to say, "Russ, they're basically seven steps. You can read them for yourself. But it is important, I can't emphasize enough, number six, get feedback in advance, as much feedback as possible. You know, you do only have three times to submit, less often on a PAR because the deadlines are rarer. So do indeed get feedback. And summary statements are part of that process. So the people who volunteer to review those applications are folks of goodwill, they're smart people like you, and they want to enable the best research possible. Here are other secrets to NIH success that you, of course, can read now and later. The one I emphasize here is this means you. There are a lot of instructions. I know they can be overwhelming, but things like children at NIH are human beings age 20 and younger. Or, yes, you are one of the people who needs to, yes, the targeted planned enrollment table, the TPET, you need to include one if you're using people. Okay? Little things like that mean a lot because your reviewers are folks who have 8 to 10 applications. You want to make it as easy as possible for them. And you can see the other tips. A lot of people don't know much about how an unscored application comes to pass. And you can see here all of the highlights. The general rule of thumb is 2.5 and poorer as a score constitutes and leads to an unscored application. That is a shorthand way to think about it, but what you should know is that the mean score can change for any panel at any different cycle. Okay, it's about the median score that occurs for each different mechanism in the preliminary scores leading into the meeting. I or another SRO would calculate for that meeting and draw up the list of unscored nominated applications that to bring to all of the reviewers and as part of our opening business, if you've never been to a review session or a study section meeting, part of the opening business is to provide the slate of unscored nominations to the entire group, at which any reviewer who does not have a conflict can object to that application, because all people without conflicts vote on applications and score those applications in a meeting. So there may be a bit of merit in an application that the three or more assigned reviewers missed. All someone has to say is, "I object," and we discuss that application in its original review order. You can see, too, that objections and nominations can occur all the way throughout the meeting. Other things that happen in a meeting, this is pretty much how it happens in chronological order. God bless you. Highlights here, there are human subjects issues that can affect the score. Perhaps if you are collecting data about sensitive or perhaps illegal behaviors, the reviewers are going to look to make certain that the human subjects are protected. That applies a lot. I mean, in community-based participatory research. Go figure. So you'd be surprised how many applications miss that when they are doing community-oriented applications. Other common discussion issues. You can see those here. There's a reason that, you know, there are five criteria that all of our reviewers use at NIH to judge the scientific and technical merits. The first of these is significance. And if the work, and there's a good reason for that, because if the the proposed project is not going to contribute to public health practice or public health theory, then how much significance will it really have on people and public health research knowledge? You can see the other discussion areas there that frequently happen. If indeed you submit applications for that first fellow I discussed with you or other applications, there are four study sections at NIH that review community-oriented research. This is for standard deadlines. My favorite, of course, is there on top, CLIP, because in public health you have acronyms you pronounce. There is CLIP at our meeting earlier this month. Nice people, they're all hotties, right? And they're all smart and nice, okay? CIB, CLIP sibling, community influences on health behaviors, that's sort of the complement to mine, that CLIP reviews mostly intervention research, CIHB is exploratory hypothesis generating research. Then we have the latter two, ENSA and NSCF. A lot of folks think that the two nursing study sections only review applications that somehow involve nurse researchers, a nurse in the intervention. Do check the referral guidelines, because you would be surprised, and the most appropriate home might be ENSA or NSCF. And that leads me to wrap things up. I don't have a photograph of me going like this, and I couldn't find anybody to take a picture of me to work that in there. So that's me, and I will turn that over to my colleague, Dr. Evans. Thanks, and good luck with your applications.
Wonderful. Well, good morning. I am so glad to be here. I'm amazed at how ascendant this idea of CBPR research is within the scientific communities that I deal with. And it's going to be my pleasure to talk about its ascendance within the NIH system. So it's an exciting time for all of us. And incidentally, I'm going to be around all day, and if any of you guys want to talk about kids or families or anything that deals with child health, I want to get to know you. So look me up. And for those of you who are looking at us remotely, at the end of the day, if you want to get a hold of me, it's Jeff_Evans@NIH.gov, and that gets to me. I'm a program officer, and I want to find you. That's my role. I'm a talent scout. I really enjoy moving around in the scientific community, looking for good ideas, looking for hot young talent, looking for hot old talent, looking for ideas wherever I can find them, and to bring them to the NIH, sort through them, and to fund the best, put the resources in the hot hand, and make progress. So that's my role. I want to find you, and you want to find me. And that's how you get started within the NIH. I am with the National Institute of Child Health and Human Development. Next Monday, right in this building, we will rededicate our name. We will become the Eunice Kennedy Shriver National Institute of Child Health and Human Development, in the name of, well, honoring the Kennedy family that really established our institute. So it'd be a special time for us. Who is NICHD? Well, we're a mid-size institute, we fit within the NIH family. And you will discover that the NIH family is quite vast, and we can't even really agree on exactly how many number of organizations we have. We have somewhere around 27, 28, 29, depending how you count them, discrete institutes and centers. And within those centers, we've got a gazillion programs. So it's a big, big, big place. So how do you get started within something that big and that vast? And I've mastered this. Okay. The first thing we want to do is find a program. We have made that easy for you with the PAs and the PARs that Bill just described to you. So we realize that if you were just starting this from scratch, sitting at your computer, you would Google NIH, you would get the NIH homepage, you would soon discover everything you need to have is right there. We're a web-based system now. You find the forms, you find the application, you get information about where you stand. Everything that you want is now made available to you through the web. Certainly finding information about a program is there. The next thing you will understand about the NIH system is, Lord, are there a number of programs. there are all sorts of programs with overlapping responsibilities, different ways of getting involved with different kinds of problems. How do you find the one that understands you? Well, I'll get back to that in a little bit, but we've made it easy for you with these program announcements. Once you find a program, you want to find somebody like me. And believe me, the system is set up so that you don't need me. You can just go do your thing, present your idea your way, at your time, and we'll respect that, and we'll do our best to find the right kind of place for you and the right kind of home for you, and do right by you. But somebody like me can help you, and I would be honored to help you. I need you, it's you and me versus the system. So find me. So find me or somebody like me. One of the first things that we're going to do together is find the right tool for the right job. And you'll also discover within the NIH, we have lots and lots of funding mechanisms. And we believe in having lots and lots of tools. And finding the right tool for the right job is one of the keys. You'll notice in these PARs that we have selected two that we think are great ways for CBPR to get started, and I'll be talking about them. But there are many, many others, and this is the kind of stuff that you'll talk with me about. You'll notice that within the centers that we have boundaries, and that the boundaries overlap, and for community-based research, it usually means that you'll have a lot of programs that will be arguably interested in what you want to do, because communities have lots of problems. One way or another, you're going to intersect with at least one of our programs, and probably many. So that's not a problem. That's actually, if you're expert in the system, you'll realize that's an advantage. But you need to know how to negotiate the system and how to use the system to your advantage. You'll notice that on the web, each program officer, like me, and we're identified. Some of us even have friendly pictures and stuff of that nature. We'll each identify the kinds of expertise that we have at our disposal and that we can share with you. The important thing about it is that you find someone who is interested in your idea, somebody who gets it, somebody who can be excited about it. And so that's what you're going to be looking for. And if you read the PARs, you'll notice that there's some people listed there, one, at least one contact for every institute. And these are people who have expertise in CBPR plus a lot of other stuff. And we get it. And we're excited about it. And that's where you really ought to start. For NICHD, you'll see my name. And that's done for your benefit. Now, another thing that you should realize is that not all NIH programs know about CBPR or use CBPR. You'll notice that on our announcements, not every institute is listed in as being interested in CBPR. That's not because they're hostile to CBPR. It's just because a lot of institutes have subject matter that really isn't appropriate for CBPR. It's pretty hard to do molecular biology in a CBPR format. On the other hand, there are many institutes that are really, really heavily involved in clinical research. Mine is one of them. And we realize the value of CBPR. And it's new. It's just starting to find its way within within the NIH system. Different institutes have different kind of history with it. You'll find, for instance, that the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences and the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute have substantial portfolios in this sort of stuff, and they have a lot of experience in it. My institute, we're just getting used to it. When I presented a CBPR idea that Lavera Jones will be talking about later on today, my institute director looked at me and said, "Boy, this sounds exciting, but you realize we've never really done anything like this before. Are you sure you want to do something like this?" And so that wasn't that long ago. But we've done it, and we're starting to see a lot of progress within the NICHD community. Let me talk about NICHD just for an example. Our interest in CBPR started with an interest in health disparities. We were putting together a strategic plan to figure out how NICHD, with its emphasis on child health and human development, how it could fit into this fast-moving subject of health disparities. And we realized that the community environment was really important. We're in the age of gene-environment interactions, and the environment is shaped by the community, and if you don't understand the community, you don't understand a lot of what you need to know. So we resolved that we better find a way how to get the most out of community-based research. And we were vaguely aware of community-based participatory research. And I and a few colleagues decided to go get smart about it and propose a subject. So we actually started with an RFA. Now, an RFA puts money on the table. It says, we're going to do this. We have a big national competition to figure out who's going to get the money and who's going to do it. We use the RFA to put together two large research networks, multi-site networks, and we gave that those networks the explicit charge to put together a plan that used CBPR principles to examine the problems of birth outcomes. So anyway, we've got those underway. It came from my initiative. It came from NICHD's initiative. That's what an RFA does. Then we joined in with these PARs. PARs give you, you guys the chance to propose research. You don't have to wait for us to set it up. You can set it up yourself. And we don't put money on the table, but what we do is we give you a review. And it means, and the practical application of that is that it assures a certain number of projects are going to get funded. We don't know which ones, but we know that the cream of the crop is going to get funded, and you're not going to get lost in the system. That's what a PAR gives for you, and we struck out in the first year, came close, but we struck out. In the second year, we had two projects from the PAR. And this year, God willing, we'll have four. We'll add four more. I like the slope. If you project that forward, we'll get eight next year. And that's what I hope. If you're interested in the PAR and you find me on that list and you call me up or send me an email, who am I and what will I do for you? Well, I have a duty to explain NICHD to you, and my first thought will be, how can I work with this person within my program, within my expertise? But it turns out NICHD is much bigger than I am, and so if you're talking about a subject matter where one of my colleagues is better able to help you, then I will introduce you to that person. And I'm not going to just introduce you to anybody. I'm going to introduce you to a person I think is going to be excited about your idea, and give you the best shot of getting funded. What you should also realize is that, chances are you could do business with Paul Cotton. I mean, Paul and I have a number of overlapping responsibilities. Shop around. Give Paul a call, too. See what Paul will do for you. The best thing in the world is to have two institutes excited about you. We expect that. We respect that. So shop around. Don't be afraid not to. As I mentioned, there are many tools for many jobs. The two that we recommend that you get used, that you get started with, are the R21 and the R01. Now there are many, many others that are possible, but the R21 is actually the perfect way to put together a CBPR project, and the R01 is a perfect way of implementing it, and it's very, very, very flexible. The R21 is an exploratory grant, if you've got a partner and you've got kind of an idea, and the idea has some exciting potential, it will give you enough resources to be able to do the preliminary work necessary to advance the proposal to the point where you can really do a full-fledged project. R01, on the other hand, is the standard workhorse. It can support small projects, it can support gigantic projects, it can support projects in between. It can do interventions, it can do anything. It can be for as long as 5 years, and it is renewable. I have many projects that are in their 20th year. You can renew it every 3 to 5 years, that's the NIH way. You start a line of research, you keep it going as long as you got good ideas. You should know that if you want $500,000, more than $500,000 per year in direct cost in any year of your project, that you're going to need special permission. And we're going to give you a hard time because we want to minimize large projects. But should you really need it, and should you convince us it's a good idea, we will give you that permission. But you need that permission to come in with a really large projects. But you can do a lot within that limit. I see a lot of red lights flashing and what have you. But let me just close and emphasize something, and that's why you need somebody like me. Because I'm going to be excited. I'm going to be a person who gets CBPR, and I'm going to be a person who knows the many ways that you can shoehorn in CPBR into the NIH system. I know people that I can introduce you to. I can give you some practical hints in developing the application. I can help you find an appropriate review environment, like Bill Elwood supervises. I'm going to be sitting there when it's reviewed and suffering with you. And after the review, I'm going to be there to share the good news or bad news with you. And then I'm going to, if it's bad news, then I'm going to huddle with you and figure out, well, what do we do next? If it's good news, I'm going to have a word in the funding decision. And you want that somebody there to have a word in your behalf. And when you get funded, I'm going to be there to help you administer the project. And when you have some exciting findings, I'm going to be the one that help you trumpet them within the world at large. So that's why you need me, and I can't do anything without you. So please, find me. Thank you.
Bring this down to a normal size along with the lapel. Good morning. I'm actually extremely excited to be a part of this esteemed panel and with this presentation. CBPR, I'm extremely excited about it. I'm actually happy to see the number of people in the room, and I've already met one person who came all the way from Oregon to be here physically instead of listening to on the web, because she just knew that during my presentation it was going to go. So she wanted to come all the way out to hear me. So I'm excited about that, and I know that this room has people from everywhere. So I'm going to go ahead and get us started and move on. I'm the Program Director for Health Behavior and Minority Health at the National Institute of Nursing Research. And I'm going to go in the right direction. Okay, I'm going to give you a very brief overview of the mission of NINR. I'm going to talk a little bit about what NINR has done with CBPR. I'm going to give you some tips for new investigators, and then I'm going to talk about the 38 CBPR grants that NINR actually funds. Okay, and I'm going to pause on this. This is probably going to be my longest slide. The mission of NINR is to promote and improve health of individual families, communities, and populations. NINR supports and conducts clinical and basic research and research training on health and illness across the lifespan. I pause on this because one of the things that I want to do, and I'm going to jump around a little bit, my first tip is don't let the name of the institute fool you. As was stated earlier, there's 27 of us, and I'm XYZ. So what I'm going to do is only going to fit in XYZ. No, it may fit elsewhere. It was mentioned earlier, when the PAs come out, there's a list of names on there. Take a look at those names. Contact all of them. The earlier you contact them, actually the better, as far as I'm concerned, from a programmatic standpoint. Don't do the usual checklist where a program is the last person. I'm going to call you, Dr. Cotton, just to let you know that I've just submitted this application. Well, I can't really help you at that point. I can look for it coming out, but I might have been able to give you some insight on what you're doing. And what can we do? We can talk to the PI when you come up with the idea. I normally request a 1 to 2 page concept paper at the maximum. I can't read your entire application. I'll never get around to getting to the person in line behind you. I can discuss the interest that my particular institute has and institutes across NIH, something that you might be a better fit with Jeff than you are with me right now. But we can talk about that. I'll review, as I said, the 1 to 2 page concept paper. I'll identify appropriate mechanisms. I mentioned previously that NINR actually has 38 current CBPR applications. They actually range from K awards to R01. You've never seen an announcement for a K for CBPR, right? Yeah, so investigator-initiated applications. We provide grant application guidance, and we explain the process a little bit. Now, what I can't do for you, even though I said I want you to call me early, I can't really tell you what to study. You're going to tell me what you want to study, and I'm going to tell you how it fits in. I really can't write the application for you, and as I stated earlier, and I have to state it many, many times, I cannot review your entire application from cover to cover for you. And actually, once it's submitted, once you submit that application, it belongs to Bill. And Bill doesn't like me talking about it until he releases it. So until it is finished with review, it's no longer mine. So I know a lot of applicants want to call during, I'll get a call or an email the morning of review. They know when it's going to be reviewed, and they want to have a conversation. Can't do that until your summary statement has been released. And one comment about the summary statement. Please review your summary statement entirely and then contact me. And we can have a well-informed conversation. You may actually want to read it and sleep on it overnight. And then kind of step away from it. Don't take it personally. Don't take it personally. And I'm going to shift back to Bill again. Don't be mean to me. It was Bill. Well, actually, it was your peers. But I can help you with that after that. Now, tips. One of the things that's extremely important at NINR and across NIH is building a team of researchers. Complementing your science with other areas of science, people that have the expertise that you may not have at this particular time. Do look for senior investigators that you can put on that are actually going to have a legitimate contribution to your research. It's extremely important. Multidisciplinary approaches are extremely important. You want to make sure that if I am, and we're all perfect, but if I don't necessarily have the expertise in one particular area, and there's someone else in my department, on my campus, or in my region, and now we're a global society, so if there's someone else that I know that can bring expertise to this particular application, contact them. Get them involved. Start with a good idea. The idea is yours. As I said, I can't tell you what to study. You have an idea of what you want to study. You want to concentrate on ideas that you start out with expertise in and a burning passion. You want to make sure that you know what you want to do and you want to do it well. Brainstorm with your colleagues. Get tips from them. What you want to also do is keep in mind that your topic should fit within NIH and within the particular IC. I've heard some great ideas that were great for other government agencies. Fabulous ideas that were great for other government agencies and other ICs. Once I took a look at them and said, well, you know, that's a great idea, and maybe I should send it over to one of my colleagues, but it doesn't necessarily fit. The NINR strategic plan is on the website. Please take a look at it, and all of the ICs have a strategic plan. Gives you an indication of what they're looking for. In terms of that summary statement, one of the things that I have a conversation with young investigators all the time is, and it's a great summary statement term, overly ambitious. You're trying to save the world in this one application. And ultimately, that is the goal. But you can't do it all in this one application in the mind of many of your peer reviewers. Be focused, be concise. An overly ambitious research plan will lead the reviewers to believe that this person has not done it before and may not be able to do it because they have everything in here. Caboodle and kit, okay? You can't put it all in that first application. You want to grow your area of science. Now, start early. Start early. And in starting early, do contact a program officer. It didn't have to be me. My feelings won't be hurt if it's not me particularly. But do contact a program officer as early as possible in the process. Don't leave us as the last thing on the checklist that, okay, I've got the application together. I know what I'm going to do, and now I'm going to contact program. Don't do it. Start early. Make steady progress. Do it. Map it out. I'm going to get to this point. I'm going to be here. And well before the submission, and now we're into electronic submission in most of the mechanisms. Make sure that if you have not submitted electronically before, make sure that you've done everything you need to do to actually submit it. If you haven't registered with grants.gov and e-commons, you don't necessarily want that to be the last thing you do the night before submission is due, because it's not going to happen. Now, submit your best work. It's extremely important. Don't rush. And that's why I say start early. You want to make sure that you have a very good first impression, and when the reviewers, your peers, have a chance to sit down and read this, that they have a real good feeling about it, and they're going to say some great things, so that when you do contact me after your summary statement is released, we'll all have an enjoyable conversation. And if that conversation is not necessarily where you want it to be, we can still, if you've taken your time and put your best work forward, the reviewers will give you comments that will be very beneficial in a resubmission. And that's the end of my presentation. And I will actually be here through the entire day so that we can have a conversation about CBPR and NINR later. Thank you.
Next up is session two, David Stoff from NIMH and Jared Jobe from NHLBI.
Well, thank you very much for asking me to come to this very important meeting. Thanks a lot, Dana, for asking me to spend a few minutes talking about what we've been doing over the last few years. And I also want to thank OBSSR in general, because we got started in this area some years ago when OBSSR took the lead on the announcements that have already been referred to. And this was actually a really nice community-based type approach, because this is the way collaboration works. You know, you connect with another institute and you learn from them. They support your involvement, and eventually you go off on your own and do your own thing. And that's sort of an approach that I think we'll be talking about here as well. So I really want to thank all the staff at OBSSR for giving us the chance to go forward in this area. I'm going to talk a bit about some of the issues that are involved in this kind of work, some of the things that we've learned over the years, and sort of where we want to go from here. Let me see if I have the right. There we are. Okay. Okay, I always start with who I am. I'm at the Center for Mental Health Research on AIDS, which has a number of different branches. It has a basic and clinical neuro-AIDS branch, a primary prevention branch, a secondary prevention branch, and also some cross-cutting programs. I'm not going to talk, of course, about our office, but suffice it to say that this kind of work has a home in almost every aspect of our office. And it's a very integrated program that we have, cutting across a number of different disciplines and a number of different areas. I'm going to also start a little bit with, I'm going to zip right through some of this, but I like to put things in a little bit of a context. And I know in a certain sense this is preaching to the to the choir, that you all know some of this, but I just want to mention some of it. CBPR is an approach. It's a way of doing things. It's not a method. These are the three main dimensions that we look at: participation, research, and action. The principles that we're all familiar with in CBPR are based on certain assumptions, that there's a partnership that's going to generate some co-learning, that there will be capacity building, that the findings that we're going to get from this work are going to benefit all partners. And it's a long-term process. It's long-term commitments that are involved. We want to focus on research questions that are ultimately of most importance to communities. We want to create a community buy-in and trust. We want to make sure that we improve reliability and validity of measurements. And we want to improve data collection. And of course, we have to make sure that things are culturally sensitive. Interventions will be targeted to the community. We have to make sure interventions use strategies that are valid, that things are eventually disseminated and translated. Now, let me get to the heart of what I want to talk about here. Over the last few years, there's been a lot of interest in this line of work. Some of it has been mentioned. I feel some of it dates back to a report by the Institute of Medicine in 2002, where they talked about a number of areas that they thought are really important for public health training. And CBPR was one of those. They talked about eight main areas. CBPR was one that they mentioned. They also talked about genomics. So that IOM report was instrumental, I feel, in the development of the importance of CBPR. There have been a lot of journals that have had special issues on this problem. There was an NIH interagency work group, and there have been funding opportunities through private foundations and also funding opportunities through NIH. Now let's just go briefly into these funding opportunities. NCMHD led the way with an R24 program that was in three different phases: a planning phase, an intervention phase, and a dissemination phase. Let me mention about this phase-type approach. Over the last few years, there's been a movement at many institutes to go more towards phased approaches than big multi-sites. Part of it is dependent upon the fiscal constraints that we have right now, and also making sure that once people get to a certain stage and do a certain line of research, that what they did is working, and they can borrow upon that for the next stage. NCMHD had a center, and also there's been a U13, conference grant by NICHD. NIEHS has been mentioned, and here are the OBSSR announcements. And NIMH came out with an announcement about a year or so ago, which was sort of a two-phased announcement, where people first would come in with an R21, a planning-type grant. If they were funded on the R21, they could then apply for the R01. So, to a certain extent, it followed the NCMHD model a few years back. Now, what have we funded in this area so far, in the AIDS area? These are just the AIDS grants that are currently funded in response to these announcements. We have other CBPR grants, but these, we only have three active grants now, three R21s. We've had a nice response. We've had about 20 grants come in, and this has only been over a couple of years now. 20 grants came in, as you can see on the bottom, about four more are pending review, and 13 haven't been funded. These are the non-AIDS grants, about the same amount, a little more have come in. The non-AIDS grants are run by Carmen Moten, so if any of you are interested in the non-AIDS area, please get in touch with her, and I'll give you her email address so that she can help you out on this. Now, one of the problems that we've experienced with respect to some of these proposals. First, some of the CBPR problems. A lot of folks have not really shown how CBPR principles are really integrated in their projects, how the community was involved in shaping this kind of work. There's been in many proposals a failure to define the community with certain criteria. There's been an underdevelopment of community partnerships. In many proposals, community translation was considered premature because it still needed some intervention work before you could translate it. More attention has to be paid to what you're going to leave behind, what's going to be the continued impact of the intervention or of the partnership or of the infrastructure after the original impact of the intervention is over. And some folks have just not been able to articulate clearly how the project matters, such as leading to best practice guidelines. There hasn't been a convincing rationale for the benefits of the partnership. Issues of innovation often came up. Many people just did not have the CBPR training in their personnel. How a lot of people certainly have community partners at the table, but haven't demonstrated by having them at the table what that's going to mean. How is that going to enrich the research process? And how is the CBPR approach going to improve dissemination and translation and long-term sustainability? Sustainability not only of the intervention, but sustainability of the partnership over time. And of course, the typical non-specific problems of generalizability, too much assessment, not having a theoretical framework, and not detailing what their dissemination plan is. Other methodological problems, not having preliminary data, things not well integrated. Okay, now here are some of the things that we've learned about some of the challenges that we face. First, the ethical challenges. We have to make sure that the research topic really comes from the community. There are all kinds of insider-outsider conflicts. Although the major purpose of this work is to benefit the community, researchers get a lot out of it. They get grants, they get publications, they get promotion, and things like that cause a lot of attention. There are constraints on community involvement. Often there are problems in putting together qualitative and quantitative data approaches. What are the dilemmas in sharing in releasing findings, making sure that that the community really has a genuine role? And challenges in the action dimension are critical. There's a very different tolerance between community members and researchers. Community members tend to want to move much more quickly. And on the other hand, researchers sort of, they want to wait until something is, let's first publish it. And then we can say something. So there are those kinds of problems. There are partnership challenges. We know that there's a very long legacy of mistrust in the community about work not benefiting the community. There is the issue of inequitable distribution of power and control, and community members are often, skeptical of whether or not there really is a equal partnership. Conflicts over funding. Who's the PI? How are the funds going to be distributed? How are they going to be budgeted? We now have a multiple PI system, which could possibly address this about some conflicts in funding. So you all ought to consider that. There are differences in emphasis in the approach, process versus versus task-oriented. Community members tend to want to focus on how we're doing things, the process. Researchers sort of just want to get the job done. So there are conflicts of that sort. It's a very time-consuming approach. You have to be committed to this for a very long period of time. There are conflicts over philosophy of things and assumptions, values, language, and finally, as I mentioned earlier, there are problems in terms of sustainability. Then the methodological questions about validity of data, proving the intervention success, the problem in specifying that all aspects of the research have to be done up front. You sometimes can't do it all up front. There are time demands and integrating research from a lot of different areas. Okay, now some ideas about where we might want to go to continue this work. We have to. Was that a, no? Do I have 5 minutes?
You're fine.
Am I clear? Okay. So we have to get a collaborative, equitable partnership. We have to get a good balance between the time spent on these process issues. We have to have priority issues, which are mutually defined. And we have to make sure that CBPR is meaningfully integrated into the community. We have to get theoretical models that look at things like unmet need, poor service outcomes, things that really do require community input. We got to focus on the strengths as well as the problems. The problems that occur in communities are important because they point out issues that we need to tackle. We have to clearly define how we're going to measure community, and we need to reach a balance in the distribution of funds. We need better funding mechanisms. We need to expand our funding programs. They have to support innovative approaches. You got to train people outside the box. They got to learn alternative research paradigms, things that are not typical. Give people training in team science. This is a great area to do team science. And team science isn't something that we really know a lot about, although we talk a lot about interdisciplinary approaches. We have to have procedures for dissemination. We've got to emphasize mentoring, capacity building, and we have to have good evaluation. Now let me end with this, sort of a controversial type thing. Does CBPR work? Well, the evidence is really pretty strong that participation actually helps the program. It improves programs. They're more efficient. They're sustained for a longer period of time. But the evidence that community participation by itself can give you better outcomes, that it can improve intervention outcomes, give you better health benefits, is much weaker. Much weaker. And that's what we've got to work on. We've got to make it stronger. That doesn't mean it's not going to work. It just means that currently CBPR works better on the program than it does on health outcomes. Let's keep that in mind. So we know that CBPR helps empowerment, so maybe that's one area that we can start addressing more seriously. So maybe since CBPR is really an approach rather than a method, maybe it's a better question that we should ask whether CBPR can improve community capacity, can it facilitate intervention development, and can it help us identify mechanisms of disparities? Those might be three areas that we can concentrate on. So I just end with these quotes about CBPR. which I know we will continue to study and eventually get much better data on, the second one in particular. CBPR is not just bringing a whole bunch of different approaches together. It's, in essence, creating something which is really very new. You get something very new from bringing it together, where it's much like a center. When we talk about centers, we talk about a center where the whole is much greater than the sum of its parts. Thank you very much.
Okay. Good morning, and I also want to add my thanks to Dana for a spectacular job of organizing this meeting. And thanks to all my colleagues for participating. I'm going to talk about lessons learned from CBPR research, a perspective from program. And I'm from the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute, and we support both basic and translational research. Translation both at T1 and T2, from bench to bedside and also into practice. Heart and vascular diseases, blood diseases, lung diseases, and sleep disorders. We have the National Center for Sleep Disorders Research within our lung division. NHLBI, as some of our previous colleagues have mentioned, we've long supported CBPR research. From these two previous CBPR initiatives, we funded three R01 applications and 10 R21 applications. And I also funded five randomized controlled trials on changing health behaviors to address health disparities in American Indian communities. And these RFAs were called Community Responsive Interventions to Reduce Cardiovascular Risk in American Indians and Alaska Natives. And we have, as I said, five sites that are ongoing from these two RFAs. And I should also mention that the Indian Health Service has a current funding announcement out called the Native American Research Centers for Health. And this is, I think, the fifth or sixth iteration of this initiative. And the interesting part about the NARCHES is that the Native group is actually the grant holder. And it mandates so that the partnership is different in that if there's a partnership between a university and a Native government, then tribe, as you will, that the tribe holds the grant and not the university. And there are specific rules within there as to the percentage of the money and how it goes, so that the tribe just does not become a pass-through. So it's a real good program, and a number of institutes, including my own, have funded projects through this mechanism, and most of the money comes from the National General Medical Sciences Institute. So the first part, I want to talk about some of the lessons learned from the review process from the previous funding opportunity announcements. Now, once you submit the application before the review, you're going to receive an institute assignment and a study section assignment. And these two assignments are independent of one another. And check to make sure that these are the assignments that you requested in your cover letter. And if not, then you should contact your program officer, and you'll get advice on how to go about trying to get that corrected. Check the Center for Scientific Review website to determine the dates that the meeting will be held, so you'll know when to expect your score to be posted on the NIH Commons. Now, what we've observed at the previous study sections, and these are also called, as Bill said, SEPs, or Special Emphasis Panels. And there's a very strict review of the science at these special emphasis panels on CBPR, Plus, they also have a strict review of the community partnerships. So it's very important that your application be strong in both of these areas in order to do well at the review. So you can't have a strong partnership and weak science, and you can't have strong science and a weak partnership. You have to be strong in both areas. So what's happened at the results of the special emphasis panels? The priority scores have tended to run somewhat high. That is worse. Another, a 1.0 is a perfect score, and a 5.0 is the worst score. So a higher score is worse. So they've tended to run a little high with relatively few priority scores that are better than 200. However, the process is set up so that this study section is percentile by itself, and so the scores are normalized. This is like a Z-score. And so the percentiling results in a relatively better percentile for a particular priority score than for most of the other study sections that review at CSR. Some of the institutes and centers at NIH, such as my own, will fund research based totally on the percentile, whereas other institutes will consider the priority score as well as the percentile. And so it's important for you when you talk to the different program officers before you submit your application, you want to discuss this with them. You also might want to ask what's their pay line. I know NHLBI has probably the best or near the best pay line at NIH. And you also want to ask them, if you're a new investigator, what programs they have for giving extra consideration to new investigators for R01s. You don't get any credit for being a new investigator in R21, but you do in R01. At our institute, we'll give you 5 points on the pay line for a new investigator with no questions asked. So our pay line right now is the 14th percentile. So we'll pay a new investigator on an R01 at the 19th percentile with no questions asked. For another 5 points, we will allow you to submit a response to the summary statement, and then your program officer will review that response and then can recommend you for funding. So potentially, you could get funded by our institute to the 24th percentile, which is very good in these times. Now, what should you do while you're waiting for the review and funding decision? So you've submitted the application. There's a 9-month process from the time your application is submitted until you could be funded. The most important thing to do, we've learned, is to continue to strengthen the relationships with your partners during this time period. Don't forget about each other during this 9-month period. We've had a problem that some of the relationships between the partners have deteriorated during this process, during this time period. And when I've contacted investigators to tell them that we're going to fund them, they tell me that they're turning down the grant because their relationship with their partner has deteriorated and they're no longer working together. So it's very important to not forget about your partner once the grant is submitted. You have to continue to work and strengthen the relationship. So what happens then after the review? We've talked about the review, what you do before the review, what you do during this period of time between the submission and the review. You can contact the institute staff after the review meeting to get a general impression of the reviewer's main points. This can be important if one of their comments is you need pilot data. This gives you an extra month or so head start before you get the reviews and post it on the commons. Generally speaking, your priority score and percentile will be posted on the NIH commons about 2 to 3 working days after the review. And then, okay. And then your summary statement comes, what's the time down now, Bill? About 4 weeks, 6 weeks?
Four.
summary statements.
No less than, no more than 30 calendar days after a meeting.
Thank you. So used to be 6 to 8 weeks. Now they've gotten it down to a month or less. Read the summary statement carefully when you get it. Put it down and walk away. If you're like me, when you read something when you're very emotional, then you don't read it very carefully. So put it down, walk away, and then pick it up again a week later. And then read it again when you're calmer. Discuss the reviews with your partners, both within your department and your partners in the community. And then contact your program officer and ask them for an appointment to talk on the phone about the summary statement. So I think I did that 3 times this past week. So when you reread the summary statement, ignore the score, focus on the comments. I take a yellow highlighter, and when I read the summary statement before we talk on the phone, I highlight each of the criticisms, and then I take my pen, and then I number them. And that way, when we talk, I have an idea of what the main criticisms are. So highlight them, and then make a list. Some people will take the summary statement from the PDF file, and they'll actually pull out the criticisms into a Word document. And then think about how you're going to respond to each of these criticisms. Ask yourself if there are any fatal flaws identified by the reviewers. And then the time comes for your appointment with the program person, and go over each of the main criticisms with the program officer. Discuss how you plan to respond to each criticism. And then ask for advice, particularly if you don't want to change the study to respond to a criticism. If I'm listening on the phone to this person and all they're saying after each criticism is, well, I'm going to have to explain that a little better, then that's an alert to me that they're in trouble. And if all you're doing is trying to explain things or saying they didn't understand it well enough, then you need to think about being more responsive. So after the discussions, then think about how to organize the introduction. You get an extra page on an R021 and 3 extra pages on an R01. And this page or 3 pages is headed by, you can either put introduction, or I like introduction to revised application. And in that first paragraph, then you say, we are very thankful for the thoughtful and comprehensive comments by the reviewers. Their reviews have improved the study. And then you go by, then you take that page or 3 pages and you go through each of the criticisms. People, oftentimes, they'll italicize the reviewer comment. And then below that, they'll explain how they responded to that. Now, it may be that you don't want to do reviewer 1, each of their comments, reviewer 2, each of their comments, reviewer 3, each of their comments. So alternatively, you can do by topic. So the reviewers had several comments about the design of the study. The reviewers had several comments about the analysis plan, that the analysis plan did not match the hypotheses. So think about how you're going to do that, and then maybe your program officer will read a draft of those 3 pages and give you some comments. That's often very helpful, because then you're going to find out if somebody thinks that you're not being responsive. Because the most important thing when you send in this amended application is to be responsive to the reviewer's comments. If there are a couple of comments that you think they really didn't understand what you're going to do, I heard one yesterday at a review where they said, well, the reviewer said they didn't include a certain test that was important. They're proposing that stress, psychological stress, mediates what's happening with the intervention, and assessing the stress level of the participants. And I said, well, that's surprising. So I wrote a note, and I pulled up the application on my computer, and it was in there about 10 times that they were assessing stress. So in this case, the reviewer made a mistake, and so you don't have to change the application. You just have to point out that maybe they didn't recognize it by the particular name that you called it, because it's not called a stress scale. It's called a psychological distress scale. So there are occasions when you want to explain things better that you didn't really explain something. And this is what I call telegraphing. And as the previous speakers noted, that each of these reviewers has 8 or 10 applications, and the research plan is 25 pages. The more you can make their job easier, the better you're going to do in the review. So for example, in your analysis plan, hypothesis 1 will be tested by a main effect from an analysis of variance looking at the groups. So telegraph it. That way, the reviewer knows that your analysis plan addresses your hypotheses. You'd be surprised how many people that their experimental design does not address their hypotheses. Their hypotheses don't follow from their aims. Their methodology is not set up to address that. So they're proposing a certain outcome variable, but that doesn't, you know, the disease doesn't cause that outcome, so that improving that particular condition doesn't cause the issue. So in other words, once you've had a heart attack and you're revascularized, you no longer have ischemia. So that if you're proposing ischemia as the outcome measure for your cardiac rehab program, they've already improved upon that before they come to you. So that's an example where it just all doesn't fit. So basically, everything has to match, or it's going to fall apart at the review. So the most important thing is don't whine. And if you do, take some cheese with your whine. Don't take the criticisms personally. Bada-boom. Don't take the criticisms personally. Be as persistent as you would with the manuscript. I've never heard anybody in my career say, well, the journal rejected my manuscript, so I threw it away, and I'll go on to something else. Yet, so many people have told me over the years that, well, I didn't get a good score, therefore I'm going to do something else. Well, you can't. I mean, how many times have people published in the third or fourth journal to which they submitted a manuscript? It happens a lot. When I was a young researcher, I had a very nice journal editor named Bob Hogan, and he rejected my manuscript, and he wrote me a very long letter, very nice, encouraged me, gave me a list of 3 or 4 other journals to send it to, and that was about the best piece of advice I ever got. And one of those other journals published my paper. So be persistent. If you don't get it the first time, you may get it the second time. If you don't get it the second time, you may get it the third time. 3 very smart people have donated their time to help me improve my study. That's the attitude. So it's the same way as with a journal review. Smart people are basically donating their time in order to help you with your research. Okay, the second part, I have another 5 minutes. I only have a couple more slides. So I want to talk about the lessons that I've learned so far from the research based upon the 2 FOIAs for American Indian communities. The most important thing is, if you're going to be conducting research in communities, especially communities of color, is, and I call this concept beyond cultural competence, and that is, so many people view the culture as a barrier to research, and it's not like that at all. The culture is an asset to your research, and you have to view it that way. And if you view it that way, so many good things are going to happen in terms of the community's enthusiasm, how much it benefits the community. And so let me give you some examples of that. In American Indian communities, they're dying. We have cultures and languages that are gone forever. And it's very important in Indian country to keep culture alive. And therefore, children and elders maintain particular points of honor. The elders are the ones who pass on the culture to the children. It's so dramatic, in fact, that once a control group was having people, the elders, sit around and talk about their culture, and they did better than the intervention group. And this is the reason, because talking about their culture inspired them to take better care of themselves. Community culture should be an integral part of the intervention. And let me give you some examples using the Lakota notion of the good red road of life. Tobacco is for ceremonial use only. You're committing a sin against native culture if you smoke cigarettes. So there's a motivation for stopping smoking, for abuse, called abusing tobacco. Traditional meats are low in fat, bison, deer, etc. Traditional vegetables are healthy. The three sisters are native corn, green beans, and squash. And in fact, in a native garden, the garden is set up so that there's a symbiotic relationship to where everything is, you grow things intermixed so that the pests are kept off of the other ones. Some pests don't like a certain thing. That plant will keep them away from the thing that they want to eat. You can increase physical activity. Native North Americans invented many popular sports such as ice hockey and lacrosse. And Native dances can be very, contain moderate to vigorous physical activity. So you can see by setting up your intervention that you can inspire people to stop smoking, inspire people to go back to traditional ways and go back to traditional diets that are much healthier than the commodities program that the white man gave us 50 years ago to stop starvation, but instead caused an epidemic of obesity. And then there's a lot of motivation for dancing and participation in more traditional sports. So you can set up an entire intervention program, as we've done in these studies, based upon the idea of going back to traditional ways, and that it was a much healthier lifestyle, because most of the diseases that are afflicting natives today are caused either by the environment, in which the white man put natives in the worst possible lands, took them off of their sacred lands, put them in places that are very difficult for a variety of reasons, and also adopting the white man's ways, being forcibly taken into schools, beaten if they spoke their native languages, having their hair cut, etc., and then being fed these commodities. What can you make with these commodities? Fry bread. And and when I go to the communities, I always say, first thing I say is fry bread is not a traditional food. It's a modern food. So we need to go back to the traditional ways. So those are some examples of how, by fully understanding the culture, having your intervention completely immersed into the culture and vice versa, that you can conduct an excellent community project. So good luck with your application. As Wayne Gretzky said, you miss 100% of the shots you don't take. So that if you don't try, you can't get a grant. Thank you very much.
Oops.
Thank you. That leads us to our third session on interventions. First up is Dr. Sabra Woolley.
Good morning.
You all have been sitting here for a while, listening very, very carefully to what's been said thus far. I've been listening very carefully to what's being said so far also. I am learning a lot from sitting here listening. You may have recognized that you are dealing with spokespersons from a number of different communities as you're listening to us this morning. We have the review community. We have the program community. Within the program community, we have the institute communities. So I am here representing the National Cancer Institute community, specifically the behavioral research program within the National Cancer Institute. We are the sponsors of the community-based participatory research program announcements and have been since their inception. I was asked to talk specifically about the R01 application, PA08-074, and about the intervention part of it. So what I'm going to try and do, listening to my the people who came before me, I'm going to change a little bit what I had planned to say. I'm going to try and crosswalk between community participatory research as a substantive area of study and looking at it within the NIH context and how, from my experience going to a lot of review groups, it is viewed and how you may be able to strengthen your applications. Just as quick background, I am trained as a cultural anthropologist and became a medical anthropologist a little later on in my career. So I was raised to do community participatory research. I doubt very much, this is being very honest, I doubt very much that if I submitted an application next week as a cultural anthropologist in the way I was trained to do community research, I doubt it would get funded. And there are very good reasons for that. The NIH context is, among other things, a biomedical context. And no matter how good we are at community-based research, it pays to be aware of the context, which we're all supposed to be good at, the context in which it's received and reviewed. Okay, just quickly, and if I use terms that don't make any sense, wave your hands around, because we all learn to speak. Part of our community is linguistic, and we learn to speak in governmentese. Okay, we're going to talk about a PA, not a PAR. What's the difference? PA is reviewed within a different kind of study section, not a special emphasis group. Therefore, you cannot assume that the people sitting around the table, although they're very, very smart folks, and they're nice folks, and they're good looking, isn't that what Bill said? Yes. You cannot assume that they are all well-versed in community-based participatory research, nor can you assume that they are already sold on the idea that it's the best way to do research, okay? So one of the things you have to do from the abstract on is to demonstrate that what you want to do is best done by community-based participatory research. There may be lots of different ways to get to the same place, but in your estimation, CPPR is the best way to do it, and this is why. Okay. Number two, because we're talking about an R01 as opposed to an R21 or an R03, that means you are going to be expected to have pilot data. In a CPPR context, that means you are going to have to establish the fact that you already have knowledge and information and have worked with the community that you're planning to do more work in. It means that you have enough pilot data, not that you know the answers. That's kind of a joke. Don't submit anything to the NIH unless you already know the answers. That's not the case. But you do need enough data to demonstrate that what you want to do is feasible and is workable within the context of your community. Oops, I knew this was going to happen. Okay, what I'd like to do very quickly is go over the general review criteria that's used and then look at it in specifically in the context of community-based participatory research. Okay, these review criteria are used by every review group. These are the areas that the reviewers are supposed to address when they write the much dreaded summary statements. Significance, approach, innovation, investigators, and environment. So when we look at that, what are we looking at? Okay, significance. All right, you want to do community-based research. So the significance of what you want to do is not only to the scientific community. It is also significant to the community that you are going to be working with. And you know it's significant because they have been essential in your whole development of the application, significant in the development of the approach, and significant in deciding what's important to them in terms of outcomes. So you got a lot of work in front of you. CPBR is not easy. It's a tough, tough way to do research. It's very rewarding, but it's also very tough and it's very time consuming, which is why the R01 is good because it gives you 5 years. Okay, so you've got to demonstrate the significance of what you want to do. Very often in a lot of our grants at NCI, people start off with SEER data. X number of people have X kinds of cancer in et cetera. Well, that's interesting, but it's not sufficient in CPPR. It is not simply giving epidemiological data of how many people have a certain kind of disease is not enough. You have to show the significance of your particular work and what difference you are going to make within the community and within the science, both. That's hard. Okay. One of the things NCI has, I should have counted up. I'm sorry I didn't. I'm not quantitatively oriented, although I should be. We have funded a number of both R01s and R21s in community-based participatory research. And one of the ones that I'm going to talk about and kind of intersperse, I should talk about it more, is a CPBR that got the highest score, the best score I have ever seen, not just for CPBR, but in general. It was like a 1.2. I mean, it was an amazing score. And it was the first time out. Now, it's an R01, and it was in a special emphasis panel, but it was just amazing. Okay. One of the things that his name is Bruce Rabkin, and he's at Memorial Sloan Kettering. His approach was to do a randomized controlled trial. Now, that can be very tough to do within a community setting, but he has managed to do it. Let me go back. Approach is something all of the reviewers are going to spend a lot of time on. If reviewers spend 15 minutes on an application, more than half of those minutes are spent, in my experience, and Bill can agree or disagree, he's had more experience, but are spent on approach, on methodology, and how you're going to do what you say you're going to do. There are a number of different ways that you can approach community-based participatory research. Within the NIH context, the classic kind of implicit, if not explicit, standard is a randomized controlled trial. For community-based participatory research, it is also extremely acceptable to look at quasi-experimental models. I just worked on a study that is largely observational and has gotten a very good score, and second time around will probably make it. Also within CPPR, mixing methods, the quantitative and qualitative methods. The most important thing in terms of your approach, in terms of your methodology, is to fit what you're doing to your research design, as well as to community preferences. For example, the use of a placebo may not be a community-approved way to go. And if that's the case, then you're not going to be successful in what you want to do. The whole notion of control group may be extremely foreign. So these are all, you know, issues that you have to think through, particularly in community-based participatory research, and make sure that the community that you're working with agrees that what you want to do and the way you want to do it is acceptable in their context, not in your context, in their context. Okay? Innovation is something that all the reviewers are supposed to look at. And for CPBR, I think this is one of the easier kind of criteria that you have to work with. But the questions that you want to answer for the reviewers is, what's new about what you want to do? What's different, and who cares that it's new and that it's different? One of the things Dr. Rabkin did that the reviewers really liked and really responded to, he's working in a community in Queens, and his New York. Everybody knows where Queens is, right? No, wrong. In New York, a borough in New York. And he is working, Memorial Sloan Kettering is a very renowned cancer institute. He is working with community libraries in Queens. And he is working with libraries as partners in dissemination of cancer information. Reviewers were very interested and very intrigued with the idea of community libraries becoming the foci for dissemination of health information. One of the other things that all reviewers have to look at is the investigators. We've had people talk to you already about collaborative teams and the importance of cross-disciplinary kind of work. I think in community-based participation, this is absolutely essential. Your team and your investigators really must include community participants and community members that have their own knowledge, their own experience, and their own abilities, and know very much what they're doing in the context of their community. You want to establish a team that indeed has complementary skills. I was just reading over Dr. Rabkin's progress report, and one of the people who is taking an instrumental role in this project has on her bio sketch community organizer / street organizer 7 years in Queens. Now, that's not something that you usually see in a typical NIH bio sketch. It is absolutely perfect for this project. Have some of them done this before? All right. Do you have experienced investigators? Now, again, this is for an R01. You can certainly be a new investigator with an R01, and like NHLBI, NCI also gives 5 points reward for being a new investigator. But if you are a new investigator, make sure that you're working with experienced investigators and make very sure from the beginning that part of your team includes community people. So, environment and people looking at community-based participatory research, are really concerned about environment. For a lot of the review groups at NIH, we look at the labs and how many nude mice you have and things like that. We have much more interesting community environments to look at, but they're essential. And explaining the environment in which you want to work is very, very important. So, who are your partners in this endeavor? How do you demonstrate that they are, in fact, your partners? That you're not doing a kind of traditional medical model of a health fair where you go out in the community and teach people what they have to know and then go back behind the walls of your medical institute. You are not doing a fly-by intervention. You are not doing a helicopter intervention. You are doing with the community an intervention that will be sustainable long after you leave, with any luck. What's your history with your community partners? How long have you been partnered? What kinds of partnership do you have? How are you going to keep it going? How are you in the 9 months that it takes, which is sort of gestation, isn't it? The 9 months it takes to NIH funding. That's a very long amount of time in the real world. Very specific, lots of details about your collaboration. And why are you interested in this community? Why is this community interested in you? Why is this community interested in doing what it is you propose to do? I've seen in one review series, not this OBSSR announcement, but in another one, reviewers that used a budget as a proxy for community involvement. Now, reviewers vote before they look at the budget, but they can look at the budget as it gets tangled into the research design, which it often does. And in this particular case, because for some applications it was so hard to figure out how the community was involved, they looked at the budget to see what kind of money was going to the community, as opposed to staying with the institutions. Okay, I'm running out of, I'm out of time. Okay. All right. We have something at NIH called CRISP, C-R-I-S-P, Computer Retrieval of something, something, something. It's on the general NIH website. It's every grant ever funded by the NIH since 1927, something, and the abstract. Bruce's abstract and his is in there. And I asked his permission, by the way, to talk about him a whole lot, and he was very glad to. But this is the one that that did so extremely, extremely well. And I don't really have time to go into this. But, you know, he demonstrated the concern about cancer prevention and specifically screening as an outcome was of concern to the neighborhood, that there was indeed in many neighborhoods in Queens a disparity in screening and in treatment. He managed to demonstrate that what he wanted to do would have generalizability and could be disseminated outside the neighborhoods in which it was originated. He's going to look at 42 libraries. He was going to randomize them to standard or community-tailored programs and compare the health behavioral outcomes in the two approaches, what he called a top-down or standard kind of public health education model, as opposed to another model in which the community library and community members developed a particular kinds of educational approach to cancer. Yes?
I'm sorry, but we really need time to
Bob now. Oh, I'm sorry. All right. Sorry, I beg your pardon. The slides are on the web. Okay, it's all yours.
Thank you,
Sarah. Sorry, I didn't know. Sorry.
To go forward. Okay. I'm going to go through the nuts and bolts of interventions. I'm not sure why I have the honor of doing this, but I'll.
It's an honor for us, Dr.
The if you're doing an intervention, how do you know you're intervening on the right thing? I mean, you might be completely off base. So you want to have some pilot data, as Sabra mentioned. It could be qualitative, focus groups, ethnography, keen form interviews, things like that. But the thing is, you want to have some basis for doing your intervention. So you're not shooting into the breeze, into the wind. And a CPPR has certain advantages because you presumably are fairly close to the community and know some of their issues and have been doing some pilot work. If you look at NIH across the board, probably interventions, I'm probably missing something, they can be in these areas, information, educational, prevention, treatment, health services. Now, the interesting thing is that a lot of the institutes actually have divisions for each, for the last three. And so if you sort of know what kind of intervention you're talking about, you might want to actually zero in on that division of that institute. There are various ways of just looking, I think a lot of you probably are thinking about prevention approaches. And if you're thinking, there's been from, you know, Institute of Medicine, CDC, WHO, they've come up with typologies of prevention approaches. Primary, secondary, maybe you've thought about, you should start thinking about what kind of prevention you're doing, of course. And so primary prevention, of course, is prevention before the disease occurs. Now, some of the things, for instance, you probably want to prevent, say, you know, cancer from ever occurring, or illicit drug use. Some things you're preventing, like alcohol use or sex, you're not going to prevent them from ever happening. They're going to happen. You're going to probably delay the onset. So, I mean, there's some prevention approaches, primary, where you're sort of delaying the onset, and others you're hopefully preventing them from occurring. Secondary prevention, you're talking about people, and a lot of our prevention approaches all are really secondary, because people have already shown some signs of having the problem, and now you're trying to prevent it from escalating or getting worse or becoming infecting others, for instance. They may already have the disease. You don't want them to spread it to other people. So another way of looking at another typology, it talks about universal targeted. Actually, I think I got the words wrong here. It's selected and targeted. Universal prevention would be for everyone in your population. Okay, everyone gets the intervention. Selected, these are people based on your lit review, your formative research, are at elevated risk. Let's say it's Latino males under the age of 30. Okay, I mean that might be your group that you're going to you select for your intervention. Targeted or indicated interventions. Let's say you in schools, adolescents get referred to their school counselor if the teachers smell alcohol on their breath or something like that. So that group would be, is an indication that we've already got a problem. So you might want to target your intervention at that group. So you can start to think about how broad-based your intervention is going to be and who's going to be in your. I'm going backwards here. You also think about the level of the intervention. Usually we think of individuals, but you can also intervene with dyads or couples, groups or networks. I mean, of course, intervening with a network, a lot of people, if you intervene with the individual, it goes back to social network and they all do something bad, but he's going to go back and he's going to go back to the same crowd. So that has given rise to a thought that we ought to intervene with networks. Not just the individual who's going back into a bad network. Or you can intervene with communities. Then you'd have a comparison with the communities that didn't get your intervention. The content of the intervention, education and informational, a lot of the interventions at NIH are psychosocial. There's a whole bunch of, you can see, types of psychosocial. At the pushing the envelope level for NIH, maybe structural, environmental. And a lot of, we're talking about policies, procedures, laws, and regulations. A lot of, if you take some areas like AIDS, for instance, you see persistently that WHO, CDC, Institute of Medicine, and groups like that have said, well, we need more structural and environmental interventions. And it's a little bit beyond the biomedical thing that NIH does, but certainly you see them coming in and getting funded once in a while, and that's something to think about. And if you're a natural experiment, kind of lends itself well to a structural environmental level, because here the PI isn't really manipulating variables. In other words, the policies are already in place in one venue, in one state, in one treatment system, program. And you compare it to a venue that doesn't have those policies, rules, regulations, and on some outcome to see how it is a natural experiment, because the PI isn't manipulating the variables, it's already in place. And what the key then is to pick out two venues that are sociodemographically pretty similar, So I mean, let's say you're talking at the state level. I may be wrong, but let's say the Dakotas are the same sociodemographic profile, But North Dakota has one kind of alcohol, policy, or drunk driving policy, laws, and the other Dakota. And then you would compare them. And this is a crude example. You would compare them on, drunk driving rates or something like that. So I mean, you're doing a natural type of experiment. You're not actually manipulating the variables yourself. And Sabra mentioned that randomized clinical trials are kind of the gold standard at NIH. However, you're not obligated, depending on the level of intervention you're working at, the sample, the topic. You may not be using an RCT, but maybe I just want to go through the characteristics of an RCT, because review committees are going to have that in the back of their mind as kind of, you know, the gold standard. So you have scientifically justified hypotheses. In other words, you're not saying, gee, I wonder if my community has more boys than girls. You know, it's like, that's, you know, you want, on the basis of your lit review, your pilot data, you're coming up with hypotheses. You're going to have a big enough sample that you can see, detect sufficient differences between the groups. You have a couple of comparison groups. Random assignment is a key characteristic to treatment and control groups. A couple of outcome measures, either, now the PI may not be blind to the treatment group, but if not, then you want to avoid confusing the opinions, expectations of patients or researchers with the treatment effects. Intent to treat analysis, I mean, everyone you randomize, you're going to follow up on. See, if 90% of your subjects drop out of the intervention, it's not fair just to look at the 10% who made it through. So you have to build in, I mean, you have to, in your analysis, build in for the fact that, you know, maybe a lot of people hated the intervention, so you still have to keep them in the study. And you have to show the committee you have some way of assessing what is the significant finding. Some checklists, sort of a checklist you might want to run through in your head as you do your application. Is your intervention manualized? You probably don't need to have that mentioned, but I mean, if your intervention's in a manual, you see, then you might have four different interventionists, but you want them all to be delivering the same dosage on the same, you know, day, the second session of the intervention. The subjects ought to be getting the same dosage, the same content, no matter who the intervention is that day. So if you have it in a manual, then it helps to standardize the dosage of the intervention, you know. So I think a lot of review committees like to see that you're intending to manualize it. Is it pilot tested? You probably don't want to just jump right into the intervention without tweaking it a little bit through your pilot testing it. Computer-assisted data collection, so much has been written in the last 10 years, you know, about how computer-assisted techniques, people give more valid answers rather than talking face-to-face to an interviewer. So, but you might, this is the good thing about the CPPR, you may decide on the basis of your pilot work with your community that they really prefer the personalissimo of talking face-to-face to an interviewer than to a computer. So it might be that you've got a good reason for not using data computer-assisted techniques, and you ought to say that, because that's one of the strengths of the CPPR approach, is you can say, it's not going to work here. These people don't like computer, you know. Different teams for the intervention, the data collection. You don't want the folks to go through 12 sessions of the intervention and then walk in the next day and be interviewed by the interventionist, because that would be a problem. Is the interventionist trained and supervised? It's not appropriate just to send the interventionists out there after training them and then never give them any feedback on how they're doing. So you probably want to demonstrate you're going to videocast or you know, videotape, audio tape the interventions, give them some feedback on their performance. How long will you follow up? I mean, a review committee is not going to be too impressed by a one-week follow-up. I mean, you have to build it in your timeline. Obviously, the longer you can follow up your participants, the better. Do you really understand why participants' behavior changed? 10 years ago or 20 years ago, this sort of breakthrough in analyses brought in the concept of mediation analysis. A lot of interventions now, applications talk about mediators. Mediators aren't necessarily what's causing the change in behavior. If you're not measuring them carefully, that could be the dependent variables changing before the mediator. So that's a tricky thing. I don't think review committees, there's no one's really licked this problem, but what I'm saying is you probably at least want to mention mediators in your proposal, because you're trying to get at exactly why people are changing. It's getting closer, even though it may not seal the deal just because you have mediators in your analysis. The advantages of CPPR, I think, are quite varied. The community can help, of course, select what is an important topic to them. It's important in their formative research. Recruitment, the choice of interventionists. I mean, being intimately involved with the community can help you, they can help you determine what works best to keeping people in the study as opposed to dropping out of it. They may clue you in as to what kind of person in terms of gender, age, education level would not be appropriate interventionist for this community. So that's an advantage of CPPR. The choice of intervention format. I mean, some intervention formats may not work well with your community, and you should be getting feedback from the community what's not going to work. And same thing with the measures, the data collection methods, the follow-up and retention. What's going to work in keeping people retained in the study? I mean, they beyond just gift certificates or money, I mean, you see in CBPR keeping people in the study using, provision of diapers to moms in the study or birthday greetings or personal touches. But the community, the relationship with the community can help you figure out what's going to work in keeping people aware, involved in the study and want to stay in the study. So that's an advantage of CPPR, I think. And finally, of course, dissemination of results, because this it makes it more likely that the results will feed back then to the community, as opposed to what we don't want to have, which is the hit and run where the PI comes in, takes the data and leaves and never comes back. So I think in these various ways, CPPR is really, although, as Saber mentioned, difficult to do, but has certain advantages. I want to thank this NIH course of a few years ago. Thank you.
Thank you. We will now break for lunch and resume in an hour.